I stood in the grass market with a chalkboard, just being like, three comedy walking tour of Edinburgh. Just built it up to the point where I was able to leave my job and do it full time. Because I was a comedian, and so I knew I could do the comedy part. But the history part, I really wanted to nail it down and be like, if anyone was on the tour and said, oh, so what about Mary Queen of Scots, or who are the Jacobites? I didn't want to be in a situation where it's like, don't worry about that, or it's just a laugh. The thing about history is, it's a thread. And once you start pulling on it, you just can't stop. I've just become addicted. I've been doing a master's degree in Scottish history from the University of Dundee, so I'm currently writing my dissertation, and it's just an obsession. I love it. So it's like being able to combine my two main passions, which is comedy and history.
Right. Hello, Daniel Downey, my old mate. How's it going, buddy?
I'm very well, thanks, mate. It's good to see you.
Aye, same, mate. It's been a while, my old comedy colleague. So I appreciate you coming through Edinburgh to do this, mate. I know you've got a gig tonight, so aye, thanks very much, buddy.
I gig in Glasgow, so it's not too bad. Flat your shell too much, you know what I mean? I'm only here because I've got to be there, Paul. Do you know what I mean? I didn't get out my way for you.
Oh, come on. Don't lie to me, then. You were begging me to do this.
Aye. It's funny, actually. Aye. I was looking at your doing very well, by the way. But it's like, so I've got Tom Boyd talking about, you know, wanting to win it for Tommy Burns. Then you got like Tommy Sheridan, one of the foremost political characters of the 20th century. Some guy who served in Afghanistan and Iraq. And then I'm like, what the fuck's Paul getting me on here for? I'm like, I'm going to have to just make something up, pretend I'm a dolphin trainer or something. I don't know.
Ah, well, I think you've been hardening yourself. You've obviously got the number one walking tour on whatever it is, TripAdvisor in Edinburgh. So you've done well there.
Well segued in there, mate. Thank you.
Exactly. Yeah, because I'm keen to hear about this. Like, what was the sort of inspiration for starting that up? If you can maybe sort of talk to us about the early days and how it's been going.
Aye, I don't know really. It's funny because I can't ever remember having like the idea, do you know what I mean, of like a kind of comedy walking tour. So just to like explain to your listeners, so I do like a comedy walking tour of Edinburgh. It's called the Mountebank Comedy Walk of Edinburgh. And it's ranked number one. It was in TripAdvisor's top 10 things to do in the UK. I think it was only one of two Scottish things. Me in a chocolate factory. So I'd fucking go to the chocolate factory. If it's a toss-up between me or that. But
that's an interesting combination.
Do you know what a mountebank is?
A chancer, basically.
Aye,
a
yeah, yeah. And so basically I had this idea that I wanted to do a comedy walking tour. But I spent I must have spent about 2 years researching and learning Scottish history. But one of the first things I did when it came to, so I learned, I kind of wanted a history of Scotland, and I went to, which I still think is the best popular history of Scotland book out there, is Magnus Magnusson's Story of a Nation. It's brilliant. Really, really good. You know, like Sally Magnusson on the telly?
The newsreader.
Newsreader, aye. Like her dad. But he used to do Mastermind.
Wouldn't there been a big show in Alcroft household, the Mastermind?
Oh, come on now. I don't believe that for a second, Paul. But no, I think the generation above us know him for that. Because
right.
I don't really remember him being as the host of that. Anyway, apparently that's what he was. But he wrote a brilliant, brilliant History of Scotland book. So basically I read that cover to cover twice, got my Scottish history down, and then when I started to learn about, right, I want to learn about Edinburgh specifically. And one of the first, I bought this wee book in a bookshop in Edinburgh, and it was like tales of like the Royal Mile and the grass market and all that. And one of the first things I read about were these mountebanks. I was like, what's a mountebank, you know? So it's kind of like, a mountebank's like a street performer, but like the difference being at the end of their performance, they sell like homemade herbal potions and remedies and stuff like that. They're like performing drug dealers basically. And I was like, hey, that's perfect for what I'm doing, right? The best one, well, that's true. Right? The best like explanation I can give with it is like an American term would be like a snake oil salesman. Do you know what I mean? So they have these like herbal recipes that cure everything. And one of my favorite ones, this isn't on my tour of the story, but I do like this story. There was a German guy called Cornelius Tilborn, right? Now, Cornelius's party piece is what he would do is he would travel like the major cities of Europe. And what he would do when he arrived somewhere, he would challenge the physicians there to concoct their most potent, dangerous medicine, or poison, sorry, right? And what he would do is he'd have his, like, assistant, drink this deadly potion, right? The guy would then pass out dead, basically. And then, I know what you're thinking, Paul, like an eccentric German guy going around poisoning folk. Who can imagine such a thing, right? But what he would do is his, like, assistant would pass out, right? And then Cornelius would give his, like, famous patented antidote, right? The guy would be immediately revived, and then there you go, hunky-dory. He'd sell bottles and bottles and bottles of this stuff, right? So he comes to Edinburgh in the 17th century, middle of 17th century, right? He's on Blackfriars Wind in Edinburgh, and he's rounding folk up, and he's like, come on, give me your worst potion, give me your worst poison. And gives it to his assistant, and the guy just dies instantly on the spot. And that was him. That was basically him ruined then after. He was like, he had underestimated Scottish people's ability to overdose. I think someone handed him a bottle of Buckfast or something. But yeah, so I was like, I read these stories about these mountebanks. There was this brilliant Italian father-son. And if you're ever in the grass market in Edinburgh, you know, you've got like the kind of the ramparts of the castle there.
Yep,
the bit that juts out, it's called the Half Moon Battery, right? And so they basically strung up a rope from the Half Moon Battery across the grass market, and they were like tightrope walking. Like, so just imagine visiting Edinburgh now and like someone just walking above your head on the grass market up to the castle. They were riding unicycles and stuff like that. And I was like, this is brilliant. And so that's where the inspiration for my name. And I got loads of pelters for it at the start. I said, nobody can spell it. Nobody understands what the fuck it is. And I'm like, but it meant something to me, you know. And that was back in maybe 2018 I did my first ones. I'll never forget my first people I had on a tour. This Australian couple. And I stood in the grass market with a chalkboard, just being like free walking tour, three comedy walking tour of Edinburgh. And they were the only two people stood there all day. They were like, right, okay, come on, we did it. And so took the couple around. And I remember, oh my God, because like you were a stand-up comic as well, Paul. But you know, you think those early gigs, those first ones, you think some of the shit that you said and did. I remember at one point in my first tour, I had a OXO cube that I put in a wee bag and was pretending to be heroin. I can't even, I mashed it up or something. It's like, I can't even remember what the joke was.
I hope you want to take a syringe out on stage.
That was like, I think that was like my idea at the time. Fuck knows. And then, that was my first tour. And then just built it up to the point where I was able to leave my job and do it full time. And I'm number one, baby.
Oh, that's class, mate. Like, so is the tour, like, obviously you had it planned sort of where you were gone beforehand. How much has it sort of changed for then to now? And are you still in touch with that Aussie couple?
They actually do, aye. I am. Well, I think, actually, now I think about it, I think they were cousins. They might be from Tasmania. I don't know. But I think he had like a wee, I've still got him on Insta. I think he had like a wee girl the other day. And I text saying congratulations. But yeah. I definitely wanted it to be like, you know, because I was a comedian and so I knew I could do the comedy part, but the history part, like I really wanted to nail it down and be like, if anyone was on the tour and said like, oh, you know, like, so what about Mary Queen of Scots or like, you know, who are the Jacobites, whatever. I didn't want to be in a situation where it's like, don't worry about that. It's just a laugh. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So I was like, but the thing about history is, like, it's a thread. And once you start pulling on it, you just can't stop. I've just become addicted. Well, I mean, I'm doing, last 3.5 years, I've been doing a master's degree in Scottish history from the University of Dundee. So I'm currently writing my dissertation. And it's just an obsession. I love it. So it's like being able to combine my two main passions, which is comedy and history. And I think the reason it's successful is just because it's the reason why most things are successful. If you are just incredibly passionate and driven by it. You know, all the people you've had in your podcast up to this point have had the same thing, you know.
I know, it's no rocket science when you explain it like that.
It's not, no, it's not. But you know, the thing about it is like, I always think it's weird how people don't see, nobody ever sees the work, you know what I mean? It's actually quite nice chatting like this and talking about being in the grass market and trying to coax people into doing a tour.
I know. I'm visualising it, like the sort of free, because when I went to Dublin, I did one of these sort of free walking tours, because I think I'd went, say, early in the morning. My mate was still working. And I was a wee bit embarrassed thinking that I'm doing this myself. People are going to think I'm some sort of fucking weirdo with any pals. I'm just waiting for my pal to finish up. And it was fucking class, by the way. So see, knowing that that's how you started, it's like, it's incredible.
But it's just, like, the thing about it is, Paul, like folk don't, I get a lot of people I went to school with or that, and they sometimes send me messages and be like, oh, like, that's class what you're doing. Like, I can't believe, you know, and you're doing comedy full time. Like, that's nuts. And I'm like, but I think, you know, folk don't see, a lot of the time I think people think one day I had a job, a full-time job, I was a teacher, and then the next day I just started mountebanking, that was it. I just switched from one to the other, you know. Whereas, like, I was working in a school in Falkirk and, like, driving, getting changed the side of the A90 into my kilt and doing tours on Wednesday nights, Thursday nights, Friday nights, working weekends, then working the whole summer holidays, then doing the fringe, then going back to work without having had a single day off, you know what I mean? And so I think a lot of folk, like, don't appreciate that side of things. They just see, it's like anything really, Instagram and all that sort of stuff. And
they see the success, they don't see the hard work and the effort. And
100%.
The days when probably you've went a day or tour and nobody's turned up, and then you're probably questioning it. And
I've done tours to one person, done tours to two, like, regularly, still now, you know, like in January, February, I was doing. But my mindset is always like, well, they're on their holiday, you know, so it doesn't matter. Well, 90% of the time they're on their holiday, you know, and it's like, I feel a responsibility to, it doesn't matter that you can't be arsed or you've got stuff on or you're embarrassed about only doing it. I'm like, they're on their holiday. So I'll go, Paul Alcroft in Dublin, and I'll fucking show him around and make sure he has the best time. And then that's how you get good reviews, and that's how you get up the rankings. And like I say, mate, it's no rocket science. Like, it's really not.
Is there any tour in particular that stands out because of maybe the audience that you had?
Oh, fuck.
The questions, or maybe what I was wondering earlier was, you're bounding about Edinburgh, right, with all these people. Sometimes the locals might have to have a wee bit of banter with you because they're thinking, what the fuck is this?
I, honest to God, like, it's a very niche market of kind of honed out for myself. There's few tour guides who will actively tell their guests to go fuck themselves or that sort of stuff. You know what I mean? I'm happy to just, I just rip the piss out of people, you know what I mean? But I had a couple from Arizona storm off last weekend. Yeah, they did not like me one bit. I was making too many jokes about Donald Trump.
Right. And then that was it?
I think it was it. They stormed off. They were like, in their defense, I defended them about 12 times up to that point. I think it was, I made a joke about Donald Trump that was the straw that broke the MAGA camel's back, you know? So I look forward to their one-star review. But I tell you, that's another thing, though. I'll tell you that about one-star reviews is sometimes they're great. Because, right, sometimes on the tour, people will leave me a four-star review and I'm fucking raging. Because I'm like, just give me the five. Like, fuck off. Do you know what I mean? I wish I could credit the comic. I seen a clip online of a reel the other day of a comedian doing a bit about a couple that leaves a three-star review and, like, what the kind of energy. It was a really good bit, actually. I wish I could remember the comic who did it. But you know what I mean? My point being is, like, just give me the fucking five-star. Like, what are you doing? But technically, it's a good review. So I can't leave a comment underneath a four-star review being like, fucking give me a five because you look petty as fuck. But if you leave me a one-star review, I'm like, all bets are off. Do you know what I mean? So I had loads of people who have come on my tour because they've read a one-star review, right? Someone who got offended or whatever. And I just left a really, really funny response. And so I've had loads of people come to tour being like, we weren't sure what tour we're going to do. And we were reading your reviews and they were all great. And then we read that one-star review and we read your reply to it. And we're like, that was fucking hilarious. Like, we're definitely going to this guy's tour now. So actually, I say people leave me a one-star or a five. I don't want anything in the middle, you know.
And any of this wishy-washy push?
Nah, none of that. Like,
what is any ones that you can remember for the one-stars that you went back on?
Oh, I can't mind, Paul.
You should do like a wee reel with that. That would be class.
Well, I've not got many. There was the woman from Kansas who got just mega offended and just bad language and all that. And I'm like, it's fucking Scotland. Like, come on. And also it's like, I say all this, like, it's not like I'm saying, oh, welcome to Daniel's family friendly tour, and then suddenly I turn up and start doing jokes about Prince Andrew and all that shit. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's all on the website. It's advertised to you. So it's like, it's getting angry when you order a Diet Coke and then get served a Diet Coke. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's daft. But I had one recently, actually. I think I've only got like two, maybe three one-star reviews. But I got, what do you call it? Shingles. I got shingles, right? Last year. So I went to the doctor in the morning and they were like, you've got shingles, so you're going to be
contagious
for a while. So phoned the guest, emailed him being like, yeah, sorry, I got shingles, so I can't do the tour this afternoon. The guy left me a one-star review entitled crap. Like, just the word crap. And he's like, this is a terrible way to treat people and all this sort of stuff. And I'm like, I was contagious. And I gave you like 8 hours notice and he got a full refund. But the problem with like TripAdvisor and all that is, I went to the people at TripAdvisor. I was like, look, this guy like has given me a one-star review entitled crap. The actual word is crap. He was completely refunded, didn't actually do the tour. Like, surely you need to remove this. And they're like, no, that's within our community guidelines. Well, fuck. It's like, I don't know. It's like a restaurant burning down and then you give it a one-star review because it burnt down and you never got to have your dinner. Do you know what I mean?
It doesn't make any sense.
Ridiculous.
What about, without getting too much away about the tour, what's your sort of favourite part of the tour? Like,
I recite a Burns poem, which I always love. One of my favourite Burns poems, Blue Eyed Lassie. And I really like that bit. It's in a lovely bit. It's in like... where the Writers' Museum is in Edinburgh, and it's like a nice courtyard, it's really pretty. And then I kind of been mainly doing jobby jokes and stuff like that up to that point, and then suddenly throw a wee bit of culture at them. Do you know what I mean?
Just to throw them off the scent.
Yeah.
What about the grass market? I did a Harry Potter tour actually with the Wayne last year, and I didn't know about all the stuff about that's where they usually take people to hang them, and some of the pubs are kind of got some unique names. Do you do anything about that?
Maggie, do they tell you the story of Maggie Dixon?
They did, but you'll tell it better than me, so.
She was a fish gawker. Maggie was a fish gawker, which means she'd sell fish in the open streets of Edinburgh. And one day her husband decides he's going to go to Newcastle to look for work. And as often as the case, when men go unattended to Newcastle, he's never heard from again. So she decides she's going to go down to Newcastle and try and find out what's happened to her husband. And on the journey down, she runs out of money. Is forced to take a job in Kelso, right? So she's working as a housemaid in Kelso, and she falls in love with the innkeeper's son. Unfortunately, she falls pregnant. This is a bit of a disaster because having a child out of wedlock in like early 18th century Scotland, she can get in a lot of trouble for this. So she decides she's going to return to Edinburgh and continue her job as a fish gawker. But she has to take steps to like conceal the pregnancy. Nobody knows she's pregnant. She'll be in a lot of trouble. And unfortunately, all the stress of hiding the pregnancy, it took its toll on poor Maggie, and she gives birth to a stillborn baby boy a couple of months prematurely. So Maggie's got her wee boy, and she does the only thing that she thinks she can do in this situation. She takes her wee boy down to the water Leith and leaves him by the side of the water, kind of baby Moses style. But unfortunately, she's caught doing this by a local fisherman who reports her to the authorities. So Maggie's arrested. She's thrown in the Tollbooth prison in Edinburgh's Royal Mile, and she's hanged in the grass market September 1722, I think. Now, there's not a dry eye in the crowd as they cut down Maggie's lifeless body, put it in a homemade coffin, and begin its journey back to Musselburgh, where she's to be buried. But while her friends are taking her body back to Musselburgh, they decide to stop in at the Peffer Mill for a drink, right? And while they're in the pub, they can hear some commotion coming from outside. And it sounds like kind of muffled screams and scratches, right? They walk outside the pub and the coffin is jumping about on the back of the cart. They open up the coffin and lo and behold, Maggie Dixon is alive and well. Maggie Dixon had beaten the hangman's rope. Paul, Maggie Dixon was nothing like myself because she was not well hung.
For fuck's sake. Oh, no.
Literally my favourite joke in the entire tour. I had a woman this afternoon, actually, who accused me of making up that whole story just so I could do that joke. I was like, I'm not that bad.
Is there not a pub? Is it the last drop?
There's a pub called Maggie Dixon's, named her honour, but that's only half the story, right? So I should finish the story. I just wanted to get my well-hung joke in. So there's big celebrations for Maggie Dixon, local lassie who's beaten the hangman's rope, but they're short-lived because she's quickly rearrested, thrown back in Edinburgh's Tollbooth prison, and she's hanged in the grass market just a week later. Except this time, as she's about to take the scaffold, this time she's about to put her head in the noose. Suddenly out of the audience, a local judge emerges and is like, ah, stop, you cannot hang this woman. You see, according to Scots law, you can't be tried for the same crime twice, right? It's double jeopardy. But not only that, like, Maggie had been pronounced legally dead, which means in the eyes of law, she was a dead woman. Like, so how'd you kill someone who's already dead? So she was released. She lived a long and happy life. She had three kids, and she's a well-known figure in the streets of Edinburgh, albeit one with a bit of a crooked neck, you know? And yeah, the pub's named in her honour, Half-Fanged Maggie, as she's more commonly known. You can read it as you go in. I think the story's on the chalkboard.
I don't think they actually told us that one, to be fair.
Yeah, maybe not on a Harry Potter tour, like, you know, the death of premature babies and stuff is maybe not.
A wee bit no kid friendly, I suppose. Yeah. No, there was another one, though. Maybe it was not the Harry Potter tour, but another tour, and I'm sure they told us it was like a witch or something. Maybe they just changed the story for there's a fishmonger to a witch.
There's loads, honestly. There's loads of incredible. Like, it's just, even like the same in Glasgow, man. Like, just when you actually learn, I did as part of my master's degree, one of the units I did. So it's like basically, so I started in April 2021, and you have to do six semesters. Each semester is about 12 weeks, and then you finish with like a research essay at the end you've got to do. So I had to do six semesters. And then I started my dissertation September last year. And then you write the dissertation, then you get the master's, right? So one of the units that I chose, you can choose, like each time that comes out. It's a really good course, by the way, for anyone thinking about it. The University of Dundee Master's in Scottish History. And I've been really impressed with it. It's been really, really good. But one of the units I did was like the Atlantic slave trade. So like Scotland's role in the slave trade. But for like centuries, Scotland's always taken a kind of because it technically wasn't in terms of actual slave trade. Do you know what I mean? So the slave ships themselves were leaving from Bristol and Liverpool and London. So they are actively ports that are engaging in the trade of human beings. But you just have to walk 5 minutes out the street there onto Glasford Street and Buchanan, and these are the
Jamaica Street,
all this sort of stuff. Exactly, yeah. You know, so these guys not only were huge slavers and they owned slaves, but also Glasgow's wealth is built on the tobacco merchants. And then after the American Revolution, they then switched the Caribbean and the sugar princes. Yeah. So I did, and of course we're not taught this in school. You know what I mean? So I did a slavery walking tour of Glasgow last November. I should give them a shout out. I can't mind who they were, the folk that did it. It was for, I think it was Black History Month, but I'm probably getting my months and everything mixed up. But it was really good. It was really interesting.
No, it sounds it. One of my mates was saying to me about potentially getting Graham Campbell in. He's like an SNP councillor in Glasgow, and I think he's spoken about this quite a lot. So
another, oh my God, I can't believe I'm going to forget his name. What's Stephen's second name? Totally forgot.
Don't worry about it.
He's written loads of books on kind of Scotland's role in the slave. Stephen Mullen. He'd be another good person to get. And he's Glaswegian as well. He's a local guy.
I know, that would be well interesting.
Really, really. And he would be able to obviously talk about it far better than I ever would. But it's funny, you know, you don't get taught these things. But I don't know, like, what was it like for you? See, when I was at school, or like, one of the reasons, right, I became obsessed with Scottish history is when I was at school. So you're kind of ages with me, aren't you? I'm going to be 37 next month. So we went to school in the kind of early noughties, right? So that was kind of like my era when I was at school, and always loved history, like loved it.
Did you get taught history at primary school? Because I can't remember a lot of history at primary school.
Personally. I remember my teacher in primary five doing a project on castles, which I was obsessed with. And then in P7 we did World War II, and we did a thing in the 1960s in P6. I remember projects. That's the way I love prod, like that's how I like see, even just a dissertation, I kind of like, it's the best way for me to learn. Give me a big project, or like writing a fringe show. That's like, just like, I can't like, I can't be like in a lecture listening to someone lecture me. Do you know what I mean? I like give me a big project and say, right, you have to have an hour show for August. I like that. That's, and I kind of just go and I get into it and go down wormholes. But yeah, I when I was at school, I loved history. And I still remember all the topics we got in history. We did German unification. We did the welfare state, World War One, and then in like S1 and S2, Native Americans, Native American Indians, Egyptology, all that stuff, right? So I end up getting an A at higher. And then my final year at school, I was like... They do a similar sort of thing. Like, so for the advanced higher, you do like a dissertation, whatever it was, right? So like a kind of, you're not doing exams, you're working on this thing the whole year. And you got to choose your topic. So I said to my history teacher, in Dingwall Academy, in the Highlands, 2006, whatever it was, 2005, 2004, I don't care what I do, but I want it to be Scottish. So it could be the Wars of Independence, it could be Mary, Queen of Scots. It could be Jacobites, Covenanters. I don't care. I just want it to be Scottish. And my history teacher told me that I had to do the American Civil War because they didn't have the resources to teach me anything in Scottish history. And I was like, how many other countries in the world are denied access to their own history? At no point from my first day in secondary school at Dingwall Academy to the day I left as an avid historian, like I loved it. I was actively seeking it out. At no point was I ever given an opportunity to learn a single bit of Scottish history. And I can guarantee you that people our age will be the exact same. They'll know of Mary, Queen of Scots. They'll know of even William Wallace, but they don't know. And so that genuinely always stuck with me. And it's something that I'm still angry about now.
I can see that.
Yeah.
Do you think there's a reason for that? And I'm the same, by the way. I didn't know about the Highland clearances, I think, until I was like...
And I'm from the Highlands, Paul. Yeah. So like I grew up there. Do you know what I mean? That's where I lived. And in my mind, in my head, that was just that's the way that it's always been. But it's not. There was a thriving population of 500,000 people in the Highlands. You know what I mean? There was communities, there was like, it was a way of life. And at no point growing up in the Highlands, in the areas of Rosshire and Sutherland, where all my mates are from, where I'd go and play football games, no one at any stage ever explained to me what had happened in these places. And my parents didn't, because they didn't know either, because they weren't taught it. Now, I mean, this was before devolution and all that. So I would maybe argue that there might be maybe there's a political reason they didn't want us to know our history. I don't know. And I would like to think, and I probably think, well, you've got a wee laddie, right? Aye. How old is?
Six.
Six, aye. So I don't know, at primary school, they probably, well, it's funny, isn't it? Because like when we were at school, if you used Scots words, you were told to stop speaking that way. Probably. And now,
Robbie Burns has become.
He'll go in and they'll have like actual Scots language lessons and stuff like that, which is great. But my assumption is that it's different now. I certainly hope it is. But that lit a fire in me, and it's always stuck with me. And so I actively try to like help people actually understand some of the history, you know, like, and I do it through, like I've got my podcast and do it through my Fringe shows. I'm up in Dunkeld next weekend doing an hour show just of like Scottish history and all that sort of stuff. I love it, mate. I love it.
No, fair play. Yeah, it is very important. And there's no doubt that I think that has been suppressed and continues to be suppressed, because if you remember back to when the referendum was happening, mm-hmm. David Cameron had met with executives at Amazon to try and get them to postpone a fucking season Outlander.
Really?
Because they were thinking that was going to somehow stir up sort of Scots, patriotism.
I always think as well, like the patronising nature of some of it is like, there was another Tory thing where they went up, and I can't remember if it was Jeremy Hunt or something like that, was like, he just like...
you can swear here, you can call him Jeremy Hunt if you want.
He was stood in front of the statue of Adam Smith and just was like, look at what our country does when we work together and all that sort of stuff. And the whole thing just smacked of, right, oh, fuck, we got to do something to do with Scotland. Right, jump on the train to Waverley. Oh, there's that statue of Adam Smith in the high street. Fucking that'll do. Like, do you know what I mean? No real understanding or care.
I think it's... you're obviously a big independence supporter, right? So obviously, I think for me, we'll just call it what it is. They're calling themselves the Conservative and Unionist Party now. They're interested in the resources of Scotland. I don't think it's anything to do with the culture. There is a shared culture, I think, but they want us to suppress our culture. And see, when like I have Americans come over to work and I tell them that sort of Gaelic language has been outlawed and the wearing of the kilt and that, they're like, "Oh, really? I didn't know this." Like,
yeah, I mean, but see, like without going. Delving too much into politics and stuff like that and keeping it on a purely historical thing. The thing that I've noticed with unionism, and I don't have a problem with unionism per se, like people who want to stay in Britain, right? I kind of understand the political position. I don't agree with it. But, you know, I would like to see Scotland be an independent country. But the thing I've noticed recently is like, so unionism of the past, I'd say in the 20th century, you know, in the 19th century, you had something called what would be, we'd probably describe as nationalist unionism in terms of what they wanted was a Scottish voice in Westminster. So you got stuff like the vindication of Scottish rights towards the end of the 19th century. So they're pushing for more MPs and more Scottish representation in Westminster, right? And then you've got a big push for home rule that comes after that. You've got the radical war of 1820 in Glasgow. They're like out on the streets trying to get voting rights and all this sort of stuff. But at this period, no one's really saying Scotland should be independent. But what they're saying is a much stronger voice within the union. We need to be listened to within the union. And there's been brilliant people from Scottish history who were unionists, people like Sir Walter Scott, like one of the biggest unionists going, right? But he's the one that a lot of the culture, a lot of the stuff that we take for granted as being Scottish is because of him. He rescued it. He wrote those stories like Waverley and rescued the Wearing of Tartan and all this sort of stuff, made it popular. But to get back to my point, because I apologise if I'm rambling here, but unionism of the past used to be, we want to remain in Britain, but we strongly, strongly want to hold on to our Scottish culture. We want to make sure that we are represented within this political union. Whereas now, I feel like the unionist position seems to be shut down. Scotland doesn't exist. Do you know what I mean? It's like, no, we're British. We're not Scottish. Scottish, stop. And then as soon as you start talking to them about their own country's history, they want to lock it down. They want to shut it down. And I'm like, that was never a thing in the past. And that's the thing that scares me. That's the thing that disappoints me. I'm like, whether you're in a support of independence or whether you're a supporter of the union, everyone should be interested in our history as Scotland and not how, not just how that ties to Britain, like our actual independent history, and accept the fact that we are an ancient nation and that life didn't begin in the 18th century, you know?
I know, I totally agree with what you're saying. A couple of points I'll say though is John McLean, I think, was like, he was leading the charge for like Scotland being independent. Obviously, a big socialist sort of guy in Glasgow. He was sort of a big conscientious objector to the sort of First World War, so I think he's worth mentioning. But I agree with you, and I've sort of talked about this with my pals a couple of times, so they don't really support, I wouldn't say Scotland too much sort of nationally, even though they're sort of left-wing kind of leaning. But I think there's, because some of them have got this kind of connection to Ireland. And I've always wondered about this, right? Which is weird for me, because I've got sort of Scottish history and Irish history. Like, the Irish are really proud of their history, and they've got loads of songs that they sing about, obviously, independence, you know, in 1916, that sort of stuff, and all the sort of the rebels, effectively. In Scotland, we don't, these songs might exist, but I'm not aware of them.
I'm a chukter. Those songs, we sing those folk songs all the time.
But see, I think this is another thing that's been suppressed, because it was in the news, there was some American guy who was like looking for Scottish rebel songs effectively, because I think this is something that had been outlawed in the past as well.
I have a bit that I do actually in my set where I talk about visiting my granny on the hottest day of the year. It was 19 degrees in Dingwall, you know, we were in over our heads. And I'll never forget this, it was the hottest day of the year, and she was sat in her front room, curtains closed, cloud of cigarette smoke, and she was listening to a song about the Glencoe massacre. There's like kids running about outside her living room window with super soakers having water fights, and she's in her front room just going like, cruel is the snow that sweeps Glencoe, give us the grave, MacDonald. But to get on to your point about rebel songs and stuff like that, it's a little bit different because Scotland remained an independent country until 1707, at which point, well, the unionist position would say we voluntarily entered into a union. The nationalist position would be like, well, bought and sold for English gold and all that sort of stuff. But it's a little bit different to Ireland because there was no conquering of Scotland. Do you know what I mean? Whereas in Ireland, starts with Cromwell, and so they've literally been colonised. Whereas Scotland can kind of go, well, we were independent, we were left alone. Cromwell comes in and creates this Commonwealth of England, and he manages to take Edinburgh and stuff, but we've not really been taken by the English, do you know what I mean? So that's where, like, the whole Bannockburn and stuff becomes so important. But I also think that's why there's not really a culture of, like, rebel songs and stuff like that, because we don't really have anything, we're not really fighting against the establishment in the same way that the Irish were.
I think he was this guy that was doing his PhD. You'd be interested in it probably. It was on the Jacobite uprising. Mm-hmm. And I think the songs that were associated
the great
with
Jacobite
that.
Songs, yeah. The Jacobites as well, though, is it's easy to get tied into that being a Scottish thing when actually it's affecting all three kingdoms. You know,
what kingdoms? You mean like
England, Ireland, and Scotland,
right?
So, you know, starts basically...
But the French not were involved with it,
the French. The French, that's who we should really fucking hate. I'm going to, do you know what, I'll, yeah, clip this bit. Because obviously we and I know this is tough for you because you're seeing a French lassie at the moment, Paul, so I apologise for this, but that, yeah, there's like the, everyone waxes lyrical about the old alliance, right? We're like, oh, we're old pals, we're in it together. Every single time, we go like 1513, the French like that, oh, we're in a bit of trouble here. Any chance you can launch an invasion of England for us? James IV, who was one of our best kings, he was great. He's like, yeah, no bother. I'll steam in England with 20,000 folk. Slaughtered. He's killed. Everything goes to shit after him. We go back to having a child on the throne. Like, all sorts of shit prod. France do this again and again and again. At no point do they ever fucking step up and go, do you know what? We'll help you out, lads. Aye, we'll do it. So I fuck the French. I didn't realise I was going to go full Brexit on this, Paul.
That's funny.
They get way too much credit, man. They never, ever fucking backed us up. If they just helped us out this one time. But yeah, no, the Jacobites is funny because it's like, they're so, again, and I didn't realise this until I started my master's degree, because so my dissertation, I'm basically, so the title of my dissertation is Push and Pull Britannia. Resisting British cultural identity in the end of the 18th century. So basically, it's about how after Culloden, the Jacobite feast finished now, they tried to push this idea of North British identity. So we're going to stop calling ourselves Scottish, we're now North Britons. And it's about cultural assimilation with England, basically. And so my dissertation about how what actually happens is you get the revert, you get a complete opposite. You get a romantic Highland identity that comes out of this, kilts and bagpipes and all that. But it's a version of Highlandism that buys into the union. It's a safe one. It's like we're not discussing anything that happened before Culloden. We'll just dress up in our kilts and tartan and stuff. But don't worry, we're still in the union. We're not going to rise again, you know. But the Jacobite rebellions in... So I did a unit, one of my semesters was on the Jacobites. And like I say, I'm in the immediate aftermath of my dissertation here. So it's from 1746 to Waterloo, 1815 is that period I'm writing about. So my eyes were really, really opened. This is a thing that's about, it's about putting the Stuarts back on the throne. And then after the union, it becomes about breaking the union. But then it comes 1715, it becomes about trying to break the Hanoverian succession, you know. So the Hanoverian, basically Anne dies. She doesn't have a air. So we go over to the Germans then, the Hanover. It's about trying to break that. Then there's religious connotations in terms of most people think it's a Catholic Protestant thing. There were Catholic cans, but it was actually mostly Episcopalian Scots. So a lot from Aberdeen, huge, that area there was a huge, back, Aberdeen, Angus, huge. Then the clans are fighting for their, like, their local clans, how they're called out. So there's so many, like, local reasons. There's national reasons. There's dynastic reasons. And this is all different depending on what country you're in. You know, you're in Scotland, England, and Ireland. But again, it's too easy to boil it down to just Scotland, England, or whatever. Because you've got to remember as well, there were Scottish people on the government side at Culloden. You know, there were British kind of Presbyterian clans, like the Campbells and the Mackays are the most famous ones. So we're Scottish. We have to make it incredibly fucking complicated, don't we?
Absolutely. You mentioned the Highlands earlier as well in terms of identity. Like, has that changed over the last, like, well, I don't know, 50 years, 100 years, 25 years as far as, like, you're aware?
Yeah, but I mean, I think it's funny because I think as Scottish people, we have a shared identity as Scots. But also, like, our upbringing for you in Glasgow to me in the Highlands, that's a huge cultural divide as well, you know? So it's really interesting. I think for Highland folk, when you grow up in the Highlands, it was funny because, like, I was just the most chuchter kid ever. I think maybe with, like, the internet and mobile phones and stuff, that's kind of less of a thing now. But, like, I remember coming down to Glasgow. My mate at Glasgow, he was at Glasgow Uni, he was in the year above me, so I went down to visit him. And we were in his student halls. And he was like, oh, man, I'm rough. I'm like, oh, we'll go to Greg's. And I was like, oh, yeah, who's Greg? And they're like, Greg's a baker. Oh, is that like a local bakery or something, is it? Like, never heard of it in my life. We had Harry Gow's up the road, do you know what I mean? Like, never, ever. And then I didn't know private schools existed. I didn't know Catholic schools existed. I thought everyone just went to the school that was nearest them. I was even naive to think that people supported Celtic Rangers just because they just chose one. Like, so this whole, like, you know what I mean? This whole kind of culture and different thing from down here compared to growing up in the Highlands.
That's fascinating.
It was honestly, it was really eye-opening. But one thing I would say, when you grow up in the Highlands, I think you have, despite what I've just said, you have a greater connection with the big cities, Glasgow and Edinburgh and stuff like that, because you have to come down here, you know. So I remember when I was like 9 years old, I used to love Bon Jovi. So Bon Jovi was playing, I think they were at Ibrox. So my dad took me down to see, do you know, but that's the sort of thing we'd have to do. The concerts were down here. My first Scotland game I went to when I was 13, it's at Hampden, right? So I still remember it, 0-0 draw against Croatia. So we have to come down to Glasgow for that, you know? And so you're always coming down for these things. If you're going on holiday, you're flying out from Glasgow or Edinburgh.
Yeah.
Whereas I think kids that grow up in Edinburgh, Glasgow, these places, they don't really have to leave their bubble, yeah. You know?
This has become a thing. They're talking about this recently where they're sort of banning new homes, having like... as a log burners and things like that, like you can't burn wood inside the house. And people are sort of saying, like, the central belt, like, we're talking about independence for Scotland, but in Scotland at the moment, we don't really understand how rural communities operate.
No, definitely not. No, that's a really fair point. I mean, I should point out, I didn't grow up in a rural community, like in a village. Like, my mum and dad weren't farmers. My mum worked in the supermarket. My dad worked in the railway. You know what I mean? So it wasn't like we were crofters or anything like that. You know what I mean? So I certainly don't want to give that impression. But there is. So like my niece and nephew are growing up in Edinburgh, and I think it's really great that they've got, my mum and dad are always like, they're like, oh, we come down and, because me and my brother are both living in Edinburgh now, and they're like, oh, we could come down and we'd see the kids all the time. And I'm like, obviously, I don't ever want to be like, oh, don't do that, you know, because when they retire, they can, if they want to do that, they can. But I think it's so great that they have a Highland granny and granda, that they have to go up, you know what I mean?
They
get exposed to, you know, being in the outdoors, and my mum and dad are great at taking them to, you know, out to the hills and feed the Shetland ponies and the Highland cow. Like, it's sounds corny as fuck, but it's...
No, it sounds like a nice life, mate.
Do you know what? It was boring as fuck growing up in Dingwall, to be honest with you.
What was Daniel Downey the teenager like?
I was just a class clown, like most comics, I think. But I was actually really shy. Like, it was... My brother was a big personality. So, like...
Is he older?
He's older than I. He was a couple of years above me at school. He's only a year, 9 months older, so we're really close in age, and we just competed all the time. But he was a big personality at school. So from day one I went into school, it was like, oh, you're Craig Downey's brother. You're like, ah, and it was either a, oh, you them or like, oh. I remember my best mate at school, his brother told him not to hang about me because I was my brother's brother, you know what I mean?
Does that mean that you didn't get battered at school because you had an older brother or?
Kind of. I never really got battered at school. I mean, I've been in thousands of fights. I've got a 100% record in fights. I've lost every single one I've been in.
But, we'll clip that, definitely. I thought you were going to say because you walk away from them.
No. I get in stupid situations. But at school, it was just like, he was quite a big personality, so I just kind of kept myself. But we would, I total class clown, just like me and my mate Billy, we used to make up silly songs and stuff like that. But just, it was growing up in the Highlands was just, I think it was just, we used to like, my mum and dad had like their work ethic was ridiculous. You know, they worked all the time. And this is the sort of thing you could never do now as well, is basically they were a young couple. And what they would do is they'd buy a plot of land, build a house on it, sell it, and then move on. So it made for at times a horrendous childhood because like,
moving on at times.
You would move into this big, beautiful house, right? And you're just like, this is amazing. I've got my own room in that. And then you'd have a year there and then you're back in some pokey flat, sharing a room with your brother, arguing all the time, you know? And then you'd go into the next one. It used to be it was the grass. Oh, man. It used to be like my dad would put grass seed down in the back garden and I'd wait for this grass to grow so I could play football on it. And then as soon as the grass was ready, they'd fucking sell the house. I swear to God, they were doing it on purpose. So we must have lived in about 9 houses, 10. Like my childhood was moving house all the time, you know.
Were you moving like into like a wide geographic area? You haven't informed.
No. It was all in like, we moved basically, the village was Conanbridge and the furthest we went was Muir of Ord, which was 3 miles away. But this is the way it worked, is like there was plots of land that you could buy. My dad, like I say, worked in railway. But he could wire the houses. My uncle Stuart, he was like a brickie, so he would do the brickwork. And then they'd all come round and put tiles. I had this stereotypical Highland family. Like my mum's the second youngest of 7, maybe it's 8. Let me count. Angus, Totty, Maggie, Stuartie.
So it's safe to say the grandparents were fond of the shagging.
Yes, I think so, yeah. I think 7. But they all helped each other out, you know. Because it was amazing, like as a kid, I was constantly surrounded by my family. We were like the Bruins. We'd go on holiday together. I still remember going abroad for the first time when I was 8 years old. We went to Rhodes and like we all went. We must have looked like the McAllisters, man.
The flight.
The Tuchter McAllisters, man. Just all the cousins, all the aunties, all the uncles. And I loved it. I loved having my family around like that. That was great. But it was great. It was lonely because I'd kick about the village and just ride my bike and I'd make up characters and noises and speak to myself all the time. But it was nice watching my family. Like they were such a good role model in terms of watching them help each other. They literally built houses from the ground up and didn't have to ask anyone for help. They could do it themselves. And here's their son telling jobby jokes in the fucking streets of Edinburgh for a living.
Well, when you talked about being a class clown, like it's social currency at school being funny, right? So is that, did you know when you were a teenager, I want to be a comic one
no,
day?
No, absolutely not. But I still remember like my art teacher, Mr. Houston, I was just being a class clown in art class and he pulled me up to his desk and he said, you should be in performing arts school. And I just laughed it off and was like, what? It's ridiculous. And actually, when I look back now, it's actually quite touching. Like, some teachers just have it, don't they? They can actually see it in kids. And it took me a long, long time after that before I ever, ever dawned on me to do something creative. Because I think as well, like, I think when you're Scottish, we talk out of ourselves. You know, when you look at American kids, you'd be like, the kid that's like the quarterback is also like in the school play. And I was like, I would have been terrified to go to school. You know what I mean? Like, it's just that I think in Scotland, to put yourself on a pedestal like that is like, you don't really get the support. You get the fucking piss taken out of you for putting yourself in those situations, you know?
Rob Kane talked up a lot about this when he was on that sort of not getting too big for your station, you know? It's a working class thing.
Yeah, definitely.
And it has its benefits because I think it does, it builds an exterior that's sort of tough and it's difficult to get through that. But if you want to really go somewhere in life, like you say, find your passion, then we need to be encouraging this sort of behaviour.
100%, mate, honestly. And also, like, I think as well, like, on that, is I spent my whole 20s and starting my 30s doing something I didn't want to do because, and it's a positive and a negative, from when I was a kid looking at my parents, it's work ethic. It's just, it doesn't matter if you don't like it, you don't ever quit. So I knew from day one that I didn't want to do the university course that I wanted to do, but I didn't want to let my parents down. And be like, I was like, right, I've got to finish this. Then I can think about doing something after that. If I had a job that I hated, you know, like I worked as a laborer in my cousin's joinery company. Fucking hated it every single day. Never, ever quit. No way. You know, work in a cafe or something. And like, so the thought of ever quitting something, no. But it's like, now I look back and I think, well, you have to have a bit of that. You know, like if your wee laddie was doing something at university and he really didn't enjoy it, you would encourage him to change what he was doing and do something else. Whereas my mindset was, no, you've started it, so you have to finish it. And that was like my family 100% instilled that. So that's why I think it was later before I started my business or got into comedy. Did I ever tell you how I got into comedy, actually?
That's my one.
Were you going to ask? Do you know Chris Forbes?
Yeah, I know Chris, eh?
Very talented comedian, Chris Forbes. I met Chris.
Duncan.
What's that?
Duncan.
Duncan, aye. Duncan Murray. I met Chris at one of the best, so I'm an Aberdeen supporter, as you know, at one of the, probably my favourite ever Aberdeen game. Do you remember me? Oh, you won't, fucking arrogant old firm fan. You won't know anything outside of your station. But when we beat Copenhagen 4-0. See, fucking honestly. We beat Copenhagen 4-0, right? It was 0-0 at halftime. Jamie Smith hat-trick. It was amazing. What a game. Thursday night at Pittodrie. This was when, like, we were playing Bayern.
Was Jimmy Calderwood?
Jimmy Calderwood,
aye. I do remember.
And we drew 2-2 with Bayern Munich at Pittodrie. Sonny Aluko. And then who's the other guy? He was playing at Edinburgh City for a while. You see, we went nowhere. Ah, what's his name again? Someone Wilson, I think, maybe. Anyway, doesn't matter.
So, no, that was Rangers and Liverpool.
No, he literally was playing at like Edinburgh City a few seasons ago. Like his career went nowhere. But he can say, do you know what I mean? He was playing at Edinburgh City and go, I scored against Bayern Munich. Fuck, man, I can't remember the boy's name. Anyway, I met Chris. So Chris is an Aberdeen fan as well. So I met Chris after the game. I was in the pub with like my mates celebrating the win and speaking to this guy. And he's like, and I was like, oh, what do you do, man? What do you do? And he's like, oh, I'm a stand-up comic. And I was like, oh, I've always wanted to try that. And so Chris goes, oh, here you go. Here's Eva at the Stand's email. So I emailed Eva at the Stand and didn't think anything of it. Just forgot about it. About 6 months later, I get a phone call. Daniel, it's a Glasgow Stand here. Are you okay to do 5 minutes tomorrow night? I didn't have a single bit of material. Had never been in a comedy club, never ever been to a comedy show, anything like that. And I was like, yeah, okay. And so I sat and wrote 5 minutes of stand-up that night, went through to Glasgow. And I think the Stand opened at 7 o'clock and I was there not realising the show started at 8:30. Sat back, you know how people like turn up at 8:20? I'd been there since 7, sat backstage in the green room. And I'll tell you what happened as well. you know, you get, you do Red Raw, you get 5 minutes. So I was going along and I was doing well, went over my time, microphone cut, lights off, my first ever gig.
Wow, you never seen them flashing you?
Never seen them flashing me. And I'd also never, I'd never been in the club. So my assumption was when they give you 5 minutes, well, if you take six, it's not. Advice for newer acts, if you get booked at Red Raw, stick to your time. That's 100% it. So that was my first ever. So I was stood there in darkness on the stage. But then the audience started cheating and clapping. So, I mean, you know the buzz, mate. It was enough to make me go back. But yeah, I have Chris Forbes to blame for me being in stand-up comedy. Never even considered it, really, until I'd met him.
No, that's a class story. That's what I was wondering then when we were talking about the sort of difference between the Highlands and Glasgow. Like, is the humour different or it's universal?
100%. 100%. Definitely. I love gigging in Glasgow. Because when I gig here, I just ramp up the chuchterness. And I feel like I just make fun of Glaswegians. But I get away with it because I'm like, I kind of put on that whole, you know, I don't know any better type thing. I absolutely play into it. The Glasgow Stand is the best. I've been doing comedy a long time now, and that's the best room in the country. But I also like Edinburgh. Edinburgh gets a pasting from Glaswegians, you know. But I actually really like gigging in Edinburgh as well. And I think it's one of the best things about being Scottish or being on the Scottish scene is I think it's class. Because like tonight, so I'm going to go do that gig tonight, right? And it'll be 95% Glaswegian or Scottish audience. And then next weekend I'm gigging in Edinburgh and it'll be Norwegians, Americans, Australians, you know, because it's much more touristy. But I think it makes you a really good comic because you have to switch it up, you know. So it's good fun. This weekend, I can talk about being a chuchter. I don't have to explain what a chuchter is. You know what I mean? Whereas like I love gigging to people who aren't from Scotland and explaining these different things. There's fun to be had in that as well.
Absolutely.
So I think it's really great going one weekend in Edinburgh where you're trying to explain what a jobby is to Americans. And then you just have to do a completely different set to your Scottish audience in Glasgow, you know. But I actually think, might be controversial doing a podcast in Glasgow, that being in Edinburgh makes you, or for me anyway, it's made me a better comic because I have to open up my material so that is more accessible. You know what I mean? I've seen a lot of Glaswegian comics come through Edinburgh and struggle because they're too... It's like we talked about before, two in their bubble.
Two parochial.
Yeah, they're like, here's my bit on the garage nightclub. And you're like, no, like you're gigging to a room full of Germans, Australians and Germans and that. Like, you know, you have to learn to open up what you're talking about, you know?
I totally agree. And when you were talking, that's kind of, whilst I was listening, I was remembering back to my days in comedy because I would do all right in Glasgow and then I would go through Edinburgh and say like I would be in the beehive, right?
Aye.
And that, like you talked about earlier, people like the success, right? But they don't like the journey, and there would be maybe eight people in there, two pensioners and six tourists. And I'm sort of looking at them and going, these cunts aren't going to get my material. That wasn't their fault, right? That was my fault. But yeah. I'm like early 20s and I just do my own material and then just kind of walk off and go, oh, that was shit.
Aye.
You know, what can I do?
Yeah.
I didn't have the sort of the wherewithal of time to go.
Yeah.
I should have probably adjusted my
but it's tough, you know,
and tried to come up with something.
When you're early in your career, though, you've only got those 5 minutes. You know what I mean? You've only got those 10 minutes.
I didn't even have 5 minutes. I just had to wing it.
But it's like, I was the same. Like, it's impossible when you start to go off-piste. So I think like that story there is, you're always going to fail in that situation to eight people in a pub above Edinburgh. I wouldn't have too hard a go at yourself. I think it's when you're down the line, you know, when you're a professional comic and you're actually doing it, that's when you have to learn to be able to do these things, you know? But yeah, no, it's, I Glaswegian humour is obviously amazing. Like Billy was a hero. Like my dad would play Billy Connolly tapes in the car and stuff like that, and grew up on that.
He is the best. I've been desperate for somebody to come in and talk to comedy with me. I was hoping Rob was going to do it, but didn't really happen. But I'm the same. Billy Connolly is by far, and I mean even in international sort of stages, he is the best comedian on the planet.
My dad was visiting me. He's flying out to Tenerife tomorrow, and so he's staying at the flat. They're flying out from Edinburgh on Saturday. And the two of us had a whiskey last night, and first thing he did was dwarf in a bus, Billy Connolly. He was like, it's almost like, it's a currency, isn't it? Like in terms of, we talk about football and then we maybe talk about music and then he'll be like, oh man, this Billy Connolly bit or that Billy Connolly bit, you know?
And it's all on YouTube now, it's on Spotify, like everybody can get it, which is amazing. I didn't actually know about the crucifixion until I moved to Glasgow and it was a lassie for East End. She's probably not listening, but Kerry Muhan, it was, it said to me, she was like, the crucifixion. And see, the first time I listened to it, mate, I thought my fucking insides were going to bust out of me. Because he mentions like places in the gallery and pubs that I sort of drink in. Yeah, and yeah. I'm like, this is the best fucking bit of stand up that has ever been done. And it's 18 minutes of just utter class, man.
Yeah. I love that bit of Glasgow as well. Like the, I was there in the Bannerlands. Seen the Saw Doctors. Do you like the Saw Doctors?
I've seen them live there.
I'm obsessed. They did two gigs in Glasgow last year and I went to both. That was another thing, my dad. That's another random thing, actually. I always say that to Irish folk when I have them on my tour. I'm like, oh, what's your favourite song? Like, I Saw Doctors, and they're like, half the time they're like, what are you talking about? And I'm like, oh, the Green and Red Omeo, that's my jam. I love that. They played, I still remember it as a kid, they played in Dingwall in like 1994 or something like that. It's like the Beatles played in Dingwall as well.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Dingwall Town Hall. You'll be amazed how many people in Dingwall were at that gig. You know what I mean? They sold it out twice over, but apparently only 10 people turned up. So I don't know how to figure that one out, Paul, you know. But yeah, no, I remember my mum and dad going out to see the Saw Doctors in Dingwall. And I swear to God, the whole village is now, or the whole town is obsessed with Saw Doctors. You walk into Mallard and it's like, I used to love her, N17 and all that. There were the songs constantly on the jukebox. And that was another one. I came down to the Central Belt and I'd meet people like, oh, what's your favourite Saw Doctors song? And I'm like, what the fuck are you talking about? You're the Saw Doctors.
It was actually my mate, my Irish mate, who got me into them. They were all coming over to watch them in the bars and then I just kind of researched them. And then there's another band too, is that, oh, the one that sings Crazy World, Aslan. You heard them?
No.
They're like similar. You should check them out. If you like Saw Doctors, you like Aslan.
I love all that. And like, but yeah, like folk music, Scottish folk music and Irish folk music. Skippinish, I go see Skippinish every December as well in the Barrowlands.
Is that the Scottish?
Aye, Joe Skippinish, Walking in the Waves and all that.
I've not seen them, but I'm noticing this trend that people are getting into folk music and it's becoming sort of bigger.
Definitely, so. Aye. But like I say, it kind of brings us back to what we're talking about at the start, is it's all positive. And any, you know, I think you can have political differences with people, but when you start trying to actually shut down history and culture and language, that's when... And music as well. That's when it gets dangerous, you know. I can't abide that.
But is that not what happened? Like, I was trying to allude to this. My understanding was that, like, Gaelic was outlawed. Like, you weren't allowed to speak it or write in it. And that's why we went for however many thousands or hundreds of them spoke it to, like, only in the sort of Highlands and Islands.
I'm always wary, Paul, of straying into victim historiography. Do you know what I mean? I think that there's a danger of constantly painting yourself as the victim and all that sort of stuff. Because I think we kind of do one or the other in Scotland. You know what I mean? We're imperial fucking heroes. We conquered the world, or we're, you know, the last colonized state and all that sort of stuff. So I try not to strain it too much. But yes, you're right. So 1746, you have the Disarming Act after Culloden. They ban the speaking of Gaelic. It started actually in the 16th century with the Statutes Iona. So they start to try and, because it's looked down upon as a barbaric and civilized nation. The Wain of Tartan, that was banned, repealed again, I think 1782, that sort of area. So yeah, I mean, I grew up in the Highlands. I can't speak a word of Gaelic, but I lived in the Isle of Lewis and most people there are fluent. You walk into the shops and people are talking to each other in Gaelic, you know. So yeah, there is definitely an element of that, but I don't know. When I lived in Lewis, it was amazing. Like listening to people speaking
in Gaelic.
I think there has been a resurgence in that. I think more people are.
They are. There's a school in Glasgow that's sort of teaching it. That's the predominant language.
People meet me down here all the time, and when you tell them you're from the Highlands, they make the assumption that you must be able to speak Gaelic and that sort of stuff. Actually, I heard a thing recently that apparently, I don't know whether this is true or not, but it makes sense, I suppose, is that the reason why the Highlands is quite well spoken, like in terms of, it's not a thick accent, you know, like obviously like Glasgow and the west of Scotland, is apparently because the population were Gaelic speaking and the people who taught them English were like the officers in the British Army who were from, you know, kind of the elites, the high society. And that's apparently why you'll find close to like the closest, like the Queen's English and places in the Highlands and stuff like that. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. Might be one of those. It might be one of those half truths. Like, yeah, if you have a pint of Guinness more than 12 yards from the Guinness factory, it tastes like shite. You know, that's like, is it true or is it not true? You know, but apparently so.
I am not sure about that because obviously up in like Orkney and all that, like I don't know how, what this, some of them are Danish and I don't know what the script is if some of them are speaking.
Yeah, they were Norse until 16th century. Orkney. You ever been Orkney?
Never. I would love to go.
Orkney's amazing. One of my favourite things in Orkney is they have a place called Maze Howe. Amazing. So it's like a Pictish burial tomb. It's about, I don't know, 4,000, 5,000 years old. Pictish burial tomb. Incredible, right? But in this Pictish burial tomb, so the Viking invasion Scotland started in like the 8th, 9th century. And Orkney, as you alluded to, is very, very proud of its Viking heritage, as is Shetland. But anyway, the Vikings are in there, right? And they're sheltering from a storm one day. And they start graffitiing the walls of Maze Howe. So now when you visit Maze Howe in the 21st century, you're in a 5,000-year-old Pictish burial tomb with like 800, 900-year-old Viking graffiti. And you're like, this is just unbelievable. It sounds cheesy, but it's almost like spiritual. Genuinely.
You can feel the presence.
It sounds cheesy as hell, but it does. Like 15,000-year-old standing stone circles and stuff like that. You know, you just can't. Or you've got Scarabrae, which is the oldest surviving Neolithic civilization in Europe. And it's people are living there 5,000 years ago, 6,000 years ago. And you're looking at it. And when I visited it, I was like struck away by how normal it was. You know, they had just like their little beds and like actual like dresser tables with wee ornaments and stuff in them.
I wonder if
5,000 years ago.
I think they were doing jobby jokes back then.
I reckon they probably were, eh? But like, honestly, amazing place to visit. I love Orkney, man. It's not like, you know, you get that image of Skye and mountains and lochs and stuff. It's a bit more barren, it's a bit flatter, but it is, it sounds cheesy. Or have you ever been to Iona?
No.
Iona is really cool as well. So Iona was basically like Christendom basically came over from Ireland. So they kind of Christianized Scotland, like Columba and all that sort of stuff. And basically the kind of the Vatican City of the Celtic Church, the kind of Rome, was Iona, this wee tiny wee island off the west coast of Scotland. And so this was like the center of the church. And then the Viking invasion start, they start raiding it and they kind of move a lot of the stuff to Dunkeld. But that's basically the heart of Celtic Christianity there, right? And then an important woman called St. Margaret, St. Margaret, basically Margaret's brother was a claimant to the throne when Edward the Confessor died. And he backed Harold Godwinson, right, at the Battle of Hastings. So he obviously gets defeated. And so Margaret is fleeing the battle and she's blown ashore at Fife. And the Scottish King, Malcolm Canmore, he rides out to meet this royal kind of shipwreck, immediately falls in love with Margaret, makes her Queen of Scotland. So this Hungarian princess is now Queen of Scotland. And the reason she's so important is because she's basically the one that takes Scotland into Europe. 900 years later, Boris would fucking take us back out again, but... she's really, really important because up to that point, Scotland's this strange kingdom in the kind of peripheries of Western Europe with this slightly strange religion. Like it's Christianity, but they're doing this weird Celtic Christianity thing there. And she basically is the one that makes Scotland at that point Roman Catholic, so brings us into the Church of Rome. And this is a really important point because it then kind of pulls Scotland into European politics and allows us to be taken seriously a bit more. So Dunfermline Abbey was consecrated in her name. So Malcolm's sons became kings of Scotland, and King David was the king when she was raised to a saint, and he built Dunfermline Abbey for her. So she's buried there.
Oh, I should go and visit
her. She's got a great you should definitely visit Dunfermline Abbey, because that's where Robert the Bruce's tomb is as well. It's amazing. That was I could go on for hours. I apologise.
No.
His tomb was rediscovered in 1822, so that was exciting. But Dunfermline Abbey is really, really cool. But I really like St. Margaret, because you know, to be a saint, you've got to have like a miracle on your record, right? Well, St. Margaret's miracle, I reckon, is the most Scottish miracle going, right? Because it is incredibly boring and uninspired, right? Because St. Margaret's miracle is, she was riding her pony over the stream, right? And as she's riding her pony over the stream, her Bible fell out into the water. And when she picked up the Bible, it was still dry. And that's it. She got a sainthood for having a Ziploc bag, for Christ's sake. Do you know what I mean? So I quite like that wee deal. She's really important figure in Scottish history. But Iona is an incredible place to visit. It's like you go there and it's like 1,200-year-old Celtic crosses and stuff like that. Incredible place. Honestly, you have to go one day. Mull as well. You go to Mull and then it's just off the bottom of Mull.
Yeah, no, when I went to Oban, sort of, that was the plan to do it, and then we just ended up getting pissed for the weekend, so...
Oban's good fun as well. But I know, honestly, mate, you should definitely go to Mull. I was there after the Fringe, not last year, the year before. Took my dog, Bran, and see if there's a day of my life I could relive over and over again. It was me and him on Iona, white sand, turquoise water, sun's beating down on us, we're swimming about in the water, just the two of us there. Like this, all these Celtic blinking 1,200-year-old crosses and stuff. Oh, man, amazing place. Apparently, they say, but I don't know if it's proven or not, that Macbeth was the last Scottish king, because the old Scottish kings used to be buried there. And apparently, Macbeth is the last one. But there's that's disputed, I think. I'm not sure if it's 100% true or not.
So if there's one place in Scotland to visit, is that Iona? Is that your
top? Oh, man, I don't know.
You may have some of your international listeners tuning in.
I loved Iona, yeah, but I think I'd be cheating on the Highlands if I didn't say somewhere a bit closer to home. It depends, doesn't it? Are you looking for history or are you looking for scenery, you know? My favourite part of Scotland is a part of Scotland called Strathcaran, Glenafric, gorgeous. Torridon, that whole part of Scotland's amazing. Torridon's like West Highlands. It looks like New Zealand, Lord of the Rings style mountains, you know. And then Strathcaran's just sat on this beautiful loch, incredible. And then Glenafric is just up for that. And Glenafric's like original Caledonian forest. So like surviving trees there that are thousands of years old, you know. Pine martens and stuff, you see red squirrels and all that running about. Come up, I'll show you. I don't, be honest, mate, I don't get up to the Highlands enough myself now. You've made me homesick.
No, it's one of my goals for this year. I'd like to get like a camper van and just go up with the rain for a week or 10 days or something.
Oh, he'd love it, man. It's funny, you know, because like, obviously with the comedy walking tour of Edinburgh, I still love Edinburgh. I think the city's amazing. I do, I love it. But when your livelihood is so tied to a place, it becomes oppressive. You know what I mean? Because like I have to be in Edinburgh. Do you know what I mean? My livelihood is, the city is basically my livelihood. You know what I mean? Because I do a walking tour of the city. So when you're there, it does become oppressive after a while. And you just need to get out and just reset, you know, and then come back.
Do you think you'll ever take on like an apprentice? You have
I don't think I could, because like my business is me. Do you know what I mean?
It's a lot of, like ad lib. Then it's like,
yeah. But even then, like I've had people ask me write comedy history shows for them and stuff like that, and I've always been like, well, no, because like if I'm gonna put. Like I say, it took me like 2 years to write this before I even did a tour. That's how committed I was to wanting it to be the best it possibly could be, you know? So I'm like, I couldn't just half-arsed write something for someone. So I'd have to put my heart and soul into it. And then if I did that, I'm like, I could give someone a page of jokes and go write those jokes. But you know yourself, like...
he might not deliver them right.
It's not. It's a complete to just hand. You can't just hand an actor a script and go do a comedy walking tour of Edinburgh. It does. It just doesn't work that way, you know. The reason I have such good reviews is because the business is me, you know. I'm basically just selling myself, essentially.
When you put it like that, I'm surprised you're charging as much as you're charging there, Daniel.
Should be charging more, to be honest with you, Paul.
You're not, as long as you're not dishing out sexual favours as part of this tour, then it's all above board. That's...
I'm a little low on sexual favours at the moment, actually. I could be doing more of them.
Right, is there anything else you want to say, Daniel? Because I'm conscious we're getting towards like 10.
What time, have I got to be over? Oh, have we really? Oh, shit. I'm on stage in half an hour.
We can call it there if you
want. I don't think so, mate. I think, I don't know. Best of luck editing all that.
I'll be fine. No, so Daniel, really appreciate you coming in today.
Of course, mate.
Is there any, where do you like people to sort of reach out to you if they want to follow you or on your tours?
At Montebank Scotland, give me a wee follow online. Listen to my podcast, and I just encourage everyone, like, obviously I'm doing academic history, which is a fucking shit show and is incredibly hard work, but the book that probably changed my life and got me to this point is Magnus Magnusson's A Story of a Nation. It's a big thick book like that, but it basically just takes you from literally day one of Scotland to the end, and I think it's the best popular history I've read because it just reads like a novel. You know what I mean? You could just read it like an actual story. So I would leave your listeners with, if you're looking for a book on, just a good book on Scottish history that's going to give you everything you need, Magnus Magnusson.
Aye, class, mate. And if you're booking Daniel's tour, book it directly so that these...
thank you for that.
They're cut.
That is very kind of you, Paul. Yeah, fuck. In fact, no, actually, cut that out. I need TripAdvisor to survive, but thank you. Yeah, please go direct to the source, definitely.
Aye, no worries, mate. Right, thanks again. I appreciate you doing this.
My absolute pleasure, mate. My pleasure.